Okay, listen, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Job. We actually left off in chapter 38, and Lord willing, we'll be able to try to finish up this book tonight. This is the climax of this book, and as you know, Job has been going through just the mental, emotional, physical, spiritual agonies of the damned in regards to everything that he has suffered and everything that's happened to him. He had no idea that this was a challenge that was thrown out by Almighty God to Satan, because in God's opinion, Job, there was none like him. He was so righteous and so upstanding, and he turned away from evil. He feared God. He was just an exemplary person, and God just had a lot of confidence in him that regardless of what happened to him in his life, he would remain faithful to him, and he would be true to his commitment to him. Anyway, you know, for those of you who weren't here, for long story short, God allowed the devil to take everything he had. He took away his children, he took away his health, he took away everything. And the poor guy was in this garbage dump scraping boils from his skin. And then he had three of his friends come by, and they sat with him for 7 days. And then the oldest of his friends began to accuse him, saying, Job, there's no way that you could be suffering like this if you haven't had secret sin in your life. And so his three friends just basically piled on him again, constantly were, you know, ripping into him, accusing him of all kinds of wrongdoing he was totally innocent of. They just figured, hey, if you're suffering, it's because you're a sinner. And Job was just constantly pleading his innocence, and Job was constantly wanting so desperately to talk to God, because that was one of his biggest frustrations, because he didn't understand where God was in all this suffering. And matter of fact, in chapter 13, he just basically demanded to have an audience with God. He just wanted to go into God's presence and just say, hey, God, what's the deal? Why are you treating me this way? And so he was kind of formulating in his mind all these questions he was going to ask God if he could just have the opportunity to speak to him, and God would speak to him back. But now what's kind of interesting is now God appears to him in this chapter 38. And instead of Job asking God questions, God turns around and he fires one question after another, after another, after another, after another, after another to Job. I mean, I counted them, and there was no less than like 89 different questions that God fires at Job. And Job, you know, has absolutely nothing to say. I mean, he can't answer God's questions. And God, in doing this, is basically showing Job very graphically that, look, I'm sovereign, all right? And you can't be questioning my justice or my goodness on the basis of your very limited knowledge and understanding, basically what God was telling him, because God used all kinds of different things. He used everything from dirt clods to stellar galaxies to challenge Job to relate to him how much he really knew. Because what we're dealing with here is a God who's infinite, a God whose thoughts are beyond our thoughts, his ways are beyond our ways, as high as the heavens are high. So when God appears to Job, Job just is dumbfounded. He cannot respond to what these questions are. But what God is doing in all of this interrogation, he's trying to show Job, listen, no mere man is in a position to be my judge or to question me or to declare that I'm unjust. Look at how many people in the world. I mean, how many times have you heard? I've heard it so many, many times throughout my life as a Christian, that people say, well, if God is so good and he is so just, then how come this little kid was run over by a car? And how come that little kid is dying of cancer? And how come this person? Well, there's so many questions that we could ask. And a lot of times people pose the questions in a way like, hey, if God is so good, how come he did this? How come he allowed that? How come he didn't stop that runaway train? How come this hurricane took so many people's lives, and so on and so forth? Well, when people question God like that, you know what they're really saying?
I'm better than
God. Really? In a sense, what they're suggesting is that, hey, I'm more righteous than God, because if I was God, I would have never have permitted this. You understand what I'm saying? So this is why we have to understand that God is way beyond our ability to comprehend and understand. He is sovereign, but we got to take it on faith that he is too good to be unkind, he's too wise to make mistakes. And regardless of what happens in our life, we can rest assured that he has a definite purpose and a meaning for it. And so I just wanted to give you that background before we even get into this, because beginning of chapter 38, verse 1, it says, then the Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Then tell me if you have understanding. Who said its measurements, since you know, or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who? Okay, now before he goes any further, it's interesting that God appears to Job in a whirlwind. All right? What this whirlwind looked like, I can only imagine, but I kind of get this picture. Now, I could be really wrong on this because this is just simply speculative on my part, but I got this impression that they probably saw this big, huge whirlwind, almost like a tornado coming at them, and this whirlwind stopped before them. And it's not only just Job there, but Job's three friends, and then Elihu's there. And there's probably a number of other people that had gathered around during the whole course of this discussion. So there's a lot of people probably witnessing this, where God begins to speak to Job out of this whirlwind. And I think it's significant, because how often does God try to speak to men through weather? There's no doubt in my mind about it, trying to get men to turn from their wicked ways and turn from their evil doings and repent and turn back to God. And God will speak to men constantly through either tornadoes or hurricanes or floods or earthquakes or forest fires, tsunamis, you name it. God is orchestrating all this all over the globe to speak to men, to get men's attention, to get men to seek him. And I think that that's kind of significant. Then he begins to fire questions at Job as far as, hey, Job, where were you when I created the earth? Look what he says here. He says, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? To tell me if you have understanding. Who set its measurements, since you know, or who stretched out a line on it? Now, here's the thing that just really galls me when I look around and I see so many people that, buy into this crock of baloney as far as evolution is concerned. Everything just happened. I mean, you look at the earth. The earth is almost 8,000 miles in diameter. And that's what God is asking him. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? The earth is almost 8,000 miles wide. You know, if it was like around, let's say, 6,000 miles wide instead of 8, no life on this planet could exist. You know why? There would be no atmosphere. Why? Because the gravity is what holds our atmosphere on the surface of the Earth. All right? If the gravitational pull wasn't exactly what it is, our atmosphere would just go off into space and no life would be possible. You look at everything. We were 93 million miles from the sun. If we were just a little bit closer, we would burn up. If we were a little further away, we would freeze. It is phenomenal. And that's why I just really get annoyed and I really get aggravated when people can think to themselves that this happened all by accident, all by itself. There's no prime mover. There's no intelligent design behind it. And that's what God is asking Job. He says here, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? I mean, God has hung the earth on nothing. It's out there on nothing, all right? And he also asked him, he says, where were you when I stretched the line out over it? We know that the earth is tilted at an axis. That line, it goes through from the north to the south pole, that the earth is at a tilt. This is what gives us our seasons. Part of the world is facing the sun, and then it goes around in its orbital path, and the other parts facing the sun, or it's tilted in such a way that we get seasons, throughout the years. God is the one that did this. I mean, look at this earth. I mean, it takes us 365 days to get around the sun. We're traveling at 67,000 miles an hour, hurling through space. We're spinning at 1,000 miles an hour on its axis, which gives us our days, a 24-hour day, day and night. I mean, you look at the ingenuity of it. You have to be willfully ignorant, I think, to believe that this just happened by itself. And that's what God is basically saying to Job. Hey, Job, were you around when I created the earth? Where were you? Can you answer any of these questions? And then he says to here in that verse 8, or who enclosed the sea with doors when bursting forth it went out from the womb, when I made a cloud its garment and thick darkness a swallowing band, and I placed boundaries on it and set a bolt in its doors. And I said, thus far shall you come, but no further, and here shall your proud wave stop. In other words, he's talking about even creating the sea. We know that the earth is almost 3/4 water. The design there is just incredible because it's that hydraulic system as far as lifting millions and millions of cubic miles of water that enable the water of the earth to bring the snow, the sleet, everything else. I mean, these things, you can see such intelligence and such sophistication and such complication behind everything. And that's what basically God is asking him. Where were you when I did all this? In verse 12, he says, have you ever in your life commanded the morning and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? Wicked people usually do their most vile deeds at night, right? That's just a fact of life. more crimes are committed at night than during the day. And what God is saying, when I bring on the morning, what happens? He shakes the wickedness out of it. And he says in verse 14, he says, it is changed like clay under its seal, and they stand forth like a garment, and from the wicked their light is withheld, and the uplifted arm is broken. And he's saying that when he brings on the dawn, he's talking about here how it's changed to clay under the seal. I think what he's talking about is when you ever see the red sky at when the sun sets, or the red sky at dawn, he's talking about, you know, how he clothes that the morning in such brilliance and such beauty, and at the same time he breaks the arm of the proud or the people who are wicked. Like I said, most of their wicked deeds are done at night. And so he says in verse 16, he says, have you entered into the springs of the sea, or have you walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you understood the expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Have you ever entered the spring of the sea, the depths of the sea? I know that some parts of the sea, they're 7 miles deep, and the pressure under there is so great, it would just crush virtually anything. But what's amazing is they have discovered that there's all kinds of different life that far down. And some of the most, I don't know, just amazing looking creatures. I mean, I look at God's ingenuity and I am truly amazed and astounding at the variety of what's there. And you go down 7 miles deep, I mean, it's so cold, it's below freezing. All right? But the water doesn't freeze because of the pressure. You look at what he's saying here, and you look at everything he's talking about. From dirt clods to stellar galaxies to the sea to the earth. He's firing one question after another to Job, saying, hey man, if you know so much, Job, then explain all this to me. Then he says here, he also asks, verse 17, have the gates of death been revealed to you? In other words, do you know where the gates of hell are? Do you know where they are? Do you know where the entrance is? If he knows so much, he should be able to tell him that. And he says here in that verse 19, says, where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness, and where is his place, that you may take it into his territory, and that you may discern the path to his home? You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. In other words, he's saying, where is the dwelling place of light, or, you know, the dividing point of light? I mean, light is really a mystery. There's not only light waves, but there's light particles, and the two interact with one another, and light can be divided up in a prism, where they can divide the light, but light is really a mystery in many, many respects, and it's really amazing as far as its ingenuity. And God is basically asking Job, hey man, do you know so much? Tell me about this. And he also said, sarcastically says in verse 21, says, you know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Now, remember what Job was saying? He was questioning God's goodness. He was questioning God's justice. All right. Well, basically, God's being sarcastic with him, saying, if you know so much, tell me, explain this to me. And then in verse 22, he says, have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of distress and for the day of war and battle? Where is the way the light is divided, or the east wind scatters on the earth? He's asking about snow and hail. Isn't it ingenious? If we had no snow, this whole planet would just be arid in many respects, because, you know, God sends the rain, but he gives us this reserve water supply through the snow. I mean, it's just amazing. It's phenomenal. That's why I get so annoyed with people who just look at something like that and just think that this has all happened by chance. He says here in that verse 25, he says, who has cleft a channel for the flood, or a way for the thunderbolt, to bring rain upon the land without people, or a desert without a man in it, to satisfy the waste in the desolate land, and to make the seed to the grass grow? In other words, he's saying, you know, explain to me, Job, why I send the rain on desert land, on arid lands, on wastelands. Well, God does it for a purpose, because there's a multitude of life forms out there that man isn't even aware of that God sustains. In verse 28, it says, has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb has come the ice and the frost of heaven? Who has given it birth? Water becomes hard like stone, and the surface of the deep is imprisoned. You know, these are interesting things. I mean, like I said, I saw a scientific film one time where they had scientists up in the snowy mountains, and they were taking snowflakes, and they were putting every snowflake they could collect, they put it under a microscope, and they had discovered that among the thousands and thousands of snowflakes they looked at, not one of them was the same. They all have a different shape, a different form. I mean, it just shows God's infinite creativity, his wisdom. He says here, in verse 30, water has become hard like stone, and the surface of the deep is imprisoned. That's another interesting thing. I saw one on one of these other science films. They put water in this cast iron ball, and they filled it with water, and then they froze it in liquid nitrogen. And, you know, water will expand when it becomes frozen. And do you see that?
called an ice bomb.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, you could encase it in metal or steel or cast iron, and that ice, that water, will just shatter that metal, you know, from its expanding. You know, and God is saying here, he says in verse 30, water has become hard like stone, and the surface of the deep is imprisoned. You see people, you know, driving their cars on frozen lakes. And then it says in verse 31, it says, can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Now God's dealing with galaxies here, and it's just incredible. I mean, Orion is the constellation that refers to as the hunter. It's just the mythology, but it's what people have named over the years as far as Orion. I think that the mythology goes that Orion and his dog Cyrus or something, they were out there hunting. They ran into seven sisters, and they tried to run them down, and then Zeus turned the seven sisters into a constellation. The seven sisters, I think, were called the Pleiades. But all I'm saying is this. You look at the stars, you look at the constellations, you look at the universe, and God is saying, hey, I created all this, and I'm in control of all this, and I'm the prime mover behind all this. You look up at the Big Dipper. You look through the Big Dipper, you know, those four stars, and you look through that. Astronomers say that just that one little portion of the night sky that they look through that Big Dipper, just that one portion, they estimate there must be a million other different galaxies that they can detect through that little portion. I mean, this is the God who is in complete control of this universe, and it is totally mind-boggling, isn't it? I mean, it really is to me. And he says in verse 32, he says, can you lead forth the constellation in its seasons and guide the bear with their satellites? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens or fix their rule over the earth? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds so that the abundance of water may cover you? Can you send forth lightning that they may go and say, here we are? The earth is struck by lightning 100 times a second. All around the world. It's struck like something like 8.6 million times a day that God sends forth the lightning. And, you know, in the United States, lightning kills more people than hurricanes or floods or tornadoes. I mean, 200 people a year die of lightning. And the Bible says that God directs the lightning bolt. And I read it one time where a guy had been struck twice with lightning. So I wonder what God was trying to tell him. I mean, you look around and you see lightning, it can heat up to like 54,000 degrees Fahrenheit. People say that lightning is God's autograph. It's his signature. I mean, it's all over the place. Who could possibly have that kind of power? Who? And it says in verse 36, who has put wisdom in the innermost being or given understanding to the mind? I think he's still referring to instinct. I mean, look at the instinct that animals have. It is incredible. I mean, we could go on all night about different instincts. But you take the Arctic tern, that bird, I mean, it could be born in the North Pole, and every year it'll go fly all the way down, you know, to the South Pole. And then it will nest down there and fly all the way back to the North Pole. How does this bird know that? It's all God has put it in their instinct. Look at the salmon. I mean, isn't it incredible? A salmon will be hatched and then go downstream, go down to the ocean. It'll go all thousands of miles, and then 4 years later, it will find the same stream it came up from. It will go miles upon miles upon miles and miles to find the exact spot where it was hatched to begin with. It will lay its eggs. Another salmon will fertilize it, and then the two of them will go off and die somewhere. Where does that come from? Is that just blind chance? Did that just happen by accident? I mean, God's the one that put that instinct within them. In verse 37, he says, who can count the clouds by wisdom or tip the water jars of the heavens when the dust hardens into a mass and the clouds stick together? In other words, God is the one who has total control over the rainfall and the amount of rainfall throughout the world. Verse 39, can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of young lions when they crouch in their dens and they lie in wait in their lair? Who prepares for the raven its nourishment, and when its young cry to God, and wander about without food. He's talking to Job about feeding all these different lions, all these different animals, everything from lions to ravens. Ravens are kind of a scavenger bird. I mean, look at some of the things that God has created. I mean, you look at the ingenuity behind it. You look at the turkey vulture. The turkey vulture is an amazing thing. All these different kind of birds that feed upon dying, decaying carcasses. You look at them and you wonder, what was God thinking when he made something like this? But you look at the ingenuity of, like, for example, these vultures. They feed on filth and dying carcasses. As a matter of fact, they don't really have teeth, so they have to really wait until an animal has died either of natural causes or has been torn apart by beasts, and they have to actually wait until the thing is beginning to really become moldy or rotten before they're able to go down there and start tearing it apart. And it doesn't matter if an animal dies of hog cholera or anthrax. Man, these birds can feed upon these carcasses and they never get sick because the digestive juices in their stomach just kill every form of bacteria. And then what's interesting is that they're just covered in all kinds of blood and filth and garbage when they eat, but then they clean themselves by eating off all the filth that's gotten on their feathers and everything. But then it's one of the few birds, or one of the only birds, that doesn't have feathers on his head. That's the way God created it. So all the bacteria and the germs on his head, all he has to do is stick his head in the sun, and the ultraviolet light burns off all the bacteria on his head. I mean, if you look at what God has done and how he's created these things, and it is a marvel, isn't it? That's why I really do get annoyed when people are forever trying to rob God of his creative genius. When you look around at what he has done and how he's done it, my mouth just falls open at just his intelligence, his creative genius. I mean, it's just absolutely astounding. And that's what God is asking him here. Can you answer any of these questions? So basically what God has done, he's given the science quiz, and Job is not able to answer any of these questions. So he begins with that chapter 39, and he says, "Do you know the time the mountain goats give birth? Or do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you count the months they fulfill? Or do you know the time they give birth? They kneel down and bring forth their young, and they get rid of their labor pains. Their offspring becomes strong, and they grow up in the open field, and they leave and do not return to them." He says, "Who sent out the wild donkey free, and who loosed the bonds of the swift donkey, to whom I gave the wilderness for a home and the salt land for his dwelling place? He scorns the tumult of the city, and the shouting of the driver he does not hear. He explores the mountains for his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. Will the wild ox consent to serve you, or will we spend the night at your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in a furrow with ropes? Or will he harrow the valley after you? Will you trust him because his strength is great, or leave your labor to him? Will you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it from your threshing floor?" Now, what he's saying here is he's using these different animals, the wild ox, the wild donkeys. He's talking about the deer calving. God is asking, hey, can you explain all these different things that animals that, you know, are far removed from men, and, you know, men know so little about? That's what he's asking there. And then in verse 13, he says, "The ostrich's wings flap joyously with the pinions and the plumage of love." It says, "For she abandons her eggs to the earth and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may trample them. She treats her young cruelly as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, she is unconcerned because God has made her forget wisdom and he has not given her a share of understanding. When she lifts up on high, she laughs at the horse and its rider." You know, this is another interesting thing about the ostrich. I mean, there's over 8,600 different species of birds, and this is the one bird that it has feathers, it has wings, but it can't fly. I mean, it can weigh up to something like 400 pounds, and it's the only bird with eyelashes, and if I'm not mistaken, it's the only bird with two toes. But the interesting thing about an ostrich is that it can run 40 miles an hour, and it can keep up that pace for up to a half an hour. It can outrun a horse. You know, but an ostrich, it says here that God is, what it says here in verse 17, because God has made her forget wisdom, she treats her her young cruelly. It's interesting. An ostrich is a very, very stupid animal. I mean, we've all heard of the proverb about hiding your head like an ostrich in the sand. Well, they don't really hide their head in the sand necessarily, but what they do a lot of times is if they see danger, if they see a person or something, they will put their head down into the sand. Or if there's a little branch of a tree sticking out, they will put their head behind the branch. And they get that big, huge rump sticking out, you know. But if they figure, well, I can't see him, so he can't see me. He's got this big, huge rump sticking up in the air or sticking out from a bush, you know. I mean, this is, they have no wisdom. They have no understanding. They treat their young cruelly because God has denied them that wisdom. They can lay eggs up to 3 pounds. I mean, one egg is more than, I think, two dozen different chicken eggs. I mean, the thing is just enormous. And you wonder, why did God make the ostrich? You look at an ostrich and you say, what a peculiar animal. But again, you see God's creative genius. You see his wisdom. You see, you know, there's nothing that can run down an ostrich. Sure, maybe a cat can or a cheetah, But it doesn't have the stamina that this bird does for very long. And in verse 19, he says, "Do you give the horse its might? Do you clothe the neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrible. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed, and he does not turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, and a flashing spear and javelin. With shaking and rage, he races over the ground. He does not stand still at the voice of the trumpet. As often as the trumpet sounds, he says, 'Aha!' And he scents the battle from afar, and thunder of the captains and the war cry." In other words, basically saying, look at the horse. Isn't it a majestic animal? It's just incredible. It is one of the most useful animals that man has had upon the face of the earth since his inception. And yet at the same time, God has put something in the horse that they're very, very effective in battle. Then he says here in that verse 26, he says, "Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars and stretching its wings towards the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the cliff he dwells and lodges, and upon the rocky crag, an inaccessible place. From there he spies out food, and his eye sees it from afar. His young ones also suck up blood, and where the slain are, there he is." And he's talking about hawks, and he's talking about eagles here. They are another amazing bird. I mean, you look at the eagle. The eagle, it can soar 100 miles an hour. And it can soar as high as 10,000 feet. And it builds its nest way up high. Eagles, a lot of times, they will come back to the same nest year after year, up to 20 years. And they've discovered a nest that is something like 20 feet in diameter. And it was like 9 feet deep. And they found everything from construction wood, 2x4s, everything else that was used by these birds to build their nest. And then God's talking about their eyesight. Their eyesight is incredibly keen, isn't it? For a man to see a quarter, let's say 35 yards away, would be very, very hard. An eagle can see a quarter, 200 yards away. Its eyesight is 6 times better than that of a man. It has incredibly sharp eyesight, and it's used for survival. You look at all these different things that God has created. That's what God is firing one thing after another at Job, saying, "Hey, man, if you know so much, explain this to me." That, to me, is where God is coming from. Anyone have anything you want to add or share to that chapter 39? Okay, this chapter 40. It says here in verse 1, it says, "Then the Lord said to Job, 'Will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it.' Then Job answered the Lord and said, 'Behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to thee? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once I have spoken, and I will not answer, even twice, and I will add no more.' It says, 'Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm and said, Now gird your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Will you really annul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be justified?'" In other words, God is asking Job, and Job, he wasn't cursing God. He wasn't cursing to his face, but he's basically saying God is being unfair, God is being unjust. And in saying that, he was condemning God. I mean, men do this all the time. Like I said, when men say that, "Hey, if God is so good, why did he do this and why did he do that?" And whenever they say that, they are inadvertently saying, "Hey, I'm more righteous than God." And in saying that, they're really condemning God. And that's what God is dealing with Job here. He's saying at verse 8, "Will you really annul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? Or do you have an arm like God?" In other words, do you have the power of God? "And can you thunder with a voice like his?" In verse 10, he says, "Adorn yourself with eminence and dignity and clothe yourself with honor and majesty." He says, "Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and make him low. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him and tread down the wicked where they stand." He says, "Hide them in the dust together and bind them in the hidden place. Then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you." In other words, he's saying to Job, "Look, are you able to humble the proud and the mighty like God does?" I mean, I look at these people, like look at this Michael Newdow. He just drives me up the wall. This is the guy who's running around trying to have the Pledge of Allegiance under God taken out of our schools. Now he's going to try to throw out "In God We Trust" on our dollar bills. And you know what? As far as I'm concerned, hey man, those are insignificant things. I mean, it doesn't matter if we have "In God We Trust" in our stinking dollar bills. It doesn't matter if we say "One Nation Under God," because as a whole, as a nation, we have forgotten God. We just give him lip service. So that doesn't mean anything. But what really irritates me is this guy is so proud. He's so arrogant. He's so haughty. You know what I mean? You know, that he would just defy Almighty God, and he thinks he knows it all.
I mean, it was Einstein who says, I don't know 0.01% of anything. And this Michael Newdow thinks he knows everything. This is how arrogant this guy is. Look at his predecessor, Madeleine Marie O'Hare. Remember her? She was the one that got God kicked out of our schools back in 1963. You know how she ended up dying? You know, her own atheistic organization. A couple of the guys, they kidnapped her. They kidnapped her granddaughter, Robin, and then one of her sons. And then they chopped him up with a chainsaw. They put him in a shallow grave there in San Antonio, Texas. You know, that's how she met her proud end. You know, and I guarantee you, where she is tonight, she's no longer an atheist. The same thing with Carl Sagan, you know, that great scientist, that great evolutionist who thought that the only eternal reality was the cosmos, was the universe. Well, he's no longer an atheist either, I guarantee it. God knows how to humble these people. He says in verse 15, he says, behold now the behemoth, which I made as well as you. He eats grass like an ox. Okay, he's talking about the behemoth here, all right? Now, I want you to understand something. A lot of Bible commentaries will have footnotes and say, well, this behemoth is the hippopotamus. Well, I want to tell you something. When we read this, you tell me, is this a hippopotamus or not? Because what he's really describing here, he's describing a dinosaur. And I think what he's describing, personally, I think it's a brontosaurus. All right? What he's describing. And God says very plainly, I made him as well as you. This is what he's saying at verse 15. Behold now, behemoth, which I made as well as you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold now, his strength is in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. Have you ever seen the tail of a hippopotamus? Does it look like a cedar? Does it look like a tree?
Like a beaver.
Or does it look like a little squirrely pigtail? You see what I'm saying? Look at this again. All right? He bends his tail like a cedar. His sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze, and his limbs are like bars of iron. Now, you look at these different dinosaurs, and I think it's kind of significant. This is why I think that this is what he's talking about here. He's just talking about this brontosaurus, all right? Because he's got a tail like a cedar. It's either this type of dinosaur or it's just this brachiosaurus right here. This brachiosaurus, give you an idea here. It's 35 feet high. It's as big as four-story building, and it weighed up to something like an incredible 89 tons. This is what we're talking about here. This is what God said that he made. He's not talking about, you know, a hippopotamus here. He's talking about dinosaur. You know what dinosaur means? Dinosaur means terrible lizard. Of course, the evolutionists and the so-called enlightened people of the day, they say, well, the dinosaurs were wiped out 65 million years ago by a comet, by an asteroid, by a meteorite, by something of this nature. They say that it must have hit the Earth, and then it caused all of this overcast and this pollution and this smut in the skies, and it just eventually withered all the vegetation, and the dinosaurs died out. But you know what? That is just, you know, a gross, flagrant lie in the face of all the facts, because everywhere they have found fields of dinosaur bones, they have discovered that these dinosaurs died in a massive flood. They didn't die from an asteroid. They didn't die from a comet. They didn't die from a meteor hitting the Earth. You know, they died from a massive flood, but they don't tell you that. You know why?
Because it confirms
the because it confirms the biblical account of Noah. So when you read this, you're reading about, in my opinion, it's a brontosaurus or some type of dinosaur that he's talking about here. Because then he says here, look at that verse 18. His bones are like tubes of bronze, and his limbs are like bars of iron. He is the first in the ways of God. Let his maker bring near a sword. In other words, nobody can confront him but his maker. He says, surely the mountains bring him food, and all the beasts of the field play there. And under the lotus plants he lies down, and in the covert of the reeds in the marsh. The lotus plants cover him with shade, and the willows of the brook surround him. If a river rages, he is not alarmed. He is confident, though the Jordan rushes to its mouth. Can anyone capture him when he is on watch with the barbs? Can anyone pierce his nose? You know, that's a kind of like a rhetorical question. But, I mean, look, we can capture hippopotamuses today. I mean, they have them in the zoos. Every time you go to a zoo, you see one. I'm just saying, look. Just take God for his word. He's the one that's describing this, and he's the one that said he made this. Anybody have anyone to add to that chapter 40? Because he goes on in this chapter 41. It's interesting. Now he describes what, in my opinion, is a marine dinosaur. Because look what he says here in verse 1 in chapter 41. He says, can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you, or will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him for a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird, or will you bind him for your maidens? Will the traders bargain over him? Will they divide him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him and remember the battle. You will not do it again. Behold, your expectation is false. Will you be laid low even at the sight of him? Does no one is so fierce that he dares arouse him? Who then is he that can stand before me? Who has given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. I will not keep silent concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his orderly frame. Who can strip off his outer armor? Who can come within his double mail? He says, who can open the doors of his face or his mouth? And around his teeth there is terror. His strong scales are his pride. Shut up as with a tight seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezes flashes forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go forth burning torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils smoke goes forth, and from his boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, flame goes forth from his mouth. His neck lodges strength, and dismay leap before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together, firm on him and immovable. His heart is as the heart of a stone, and even as a heart as a lower millstone. And when he raises himself up, the mighty fear, because of the crashing, they are bewildered. The sword that reaches him cannot avail, nor the spear and the dart, nor the javelin. He regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrows cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned into a stubble before him. Clubs are regarded as stubble, and he laughs at the rattling of the javelin. His underparts are like the sharp pot shears, and he spreads out like a threshing sledge on the mire. He makes the depths boil like a pot, and he makes the sea like a jar of ointment. Behind him, he makes the wake to shine. One would think the deep to be gray-haired. Nothing on earth is like him, one made without fear. He looks on everything that is high, and he is king over all the sons of pride. Now, I read this whole thing because God is continuing to describe this creature. All right? Now, Bible commentators say, well, this must be a crocodile. This must be an alligator. To me, in my opinion, you've got to be living on the moon to come to that conclusion. Okay? And here's another thing. All right? It talked about this situation where it says that, you know, he breathes forth like fire. All right. You tell me. Where do we get this whole notion of dragon, fire-breathing dragons? You know what I'm saying? Where does that come from? Is that just pure myth? Is that just pure legend? Or is there something behind it? And, you know, the Bible talks of Leviathan. It talks about it, I think, at three or four different places. It talks about it in Isaiah, and it talks about it in the Psalms. I think Psalm 104. But Satan is referred to as Leviathan, as this great dragon is referred to as Rahab, the Leviathan. In other words, what I'm getting at is this. There's more than just simply myth here. There's some reality to it. Look at the bombardier beetle. This is a beetle that, you know, is able to, when it is attacked or it is threatened, it will raise up its rear end and it will fire this scalding hot chemical composition at its enemy. It'll either kill him or blind him or put him on the run. And so, if God can do that in an insect, could not he have done it in one of these terrible lizards where they could have actually have breathed forth fire? You see what I'm saying? All right? So I don't think it's just pure myth here, because even you go to the book of Revelation, Satan himself is referred to as a great red dragon with seven heads and 10 horns. You see what I'm saying? So it goes way beyond myth and legend. There's reality to this, and it can be seen in God's creation, and it can be seen in these dinosaurs. You see, the Bible talks about dinosaurs, but people don't realize it. They don't see it. They don't understand it. They think, well, the Bible's got to be obsolete because the dinosaurs have been around, were around 65 million years ago. Well, that's all bunk. The dinosaurs walk right alongside man. As a matter of fact, in Texas, they have discovered a footprint of a dinosaur, and inside the footprint of a dinosaur, a fossilized footprint of a dinosaur, there is a man's footprint inside of his footprint. There's all kinds of evidence to suggest that dinosaurs and men walk together. But keep something in mind. When God created dinosaurs, he created man, he created the world, he created all these creatures. You know, everything was living in perfect harmony. And these dinosaurs weren't carnivorous. Everything ate plant life, all right? Because God even said very plainly, he says that when God destroyed the world with a flood, and he told Noah, see, I've given you everything that moves for your food, just as I gave you every living plant, every creature, every living plant. When God created everything, it was animals weren't feeding on one another. Men weren't feeding on animals, all right? There was no cannibalism going on. Animals and beasts and birds and fish alike, they all ate vegetation. You know, it was only after the flood that because the geography, the topography, the environment of the world was so radically transformed that now creatures, in order to survive, began to feed on one another. I mean, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but I'm just simply saying there's a logical explanation for everything if you look at it from a biblical perspective. And people don't realize it. God describes these creatures that he made, and they weren't wiped out by some kind of asteroid. They were wiped out with a flood. All right, listen, this chapter 42, this is the conclusion of this book. And it says in verse 1 in chapter 42, it says, then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that thou canst do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have declared that which I did not understand. And that's what God asked him in that chapter 38. He says, who is this who darkens counsel without knowledge? In other words, how many people darken counsel without knowing the facts? In other words, they accuse God of wrongdoing without knowing what's going on. And in verse 3 it says, who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear now, and I will speak. I will ask thee, and do thou instruct me. It says, I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. Therefore I retract, and I repent in dust and ashes. And that's very significant, because what Job is saying here, I think, is basically he's saying, look, I've heard of you, but now I've seen you. And now that I've seen you, I retract everything I've said, and I just humble myself in dust and ashes. And that's kind of interesting to me. It's kind of significant. People have heard about God. You know, they've heard about God. Not too many people in this world have not heard about God, all right? Every atheist on this planet has heard about God, all right? See what I'm saying? It's one thing to hear about God. It's another thing to come to a one-on-one encounter with God, an experience with God. And Job is basically saying this in verse 5, I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee, therefore I retract and I repent in dust and ashes. It's a total different experience, all right, when he comes to an encounter with God himself. Now, Job was a man who feared God, who knew God, who loved God, who followed God, obeyed God, but this experience has really opened his eyes and brought him to a whole new level in his understanding about God. And he says in verse 7, it says, and it came about after the Lord had spoken these words to Job that the Lord said to Eliphaz, the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Now therefore take for yourself 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves and my servant Job will pray for you. For I will accept him so that I may not do with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamanite went and did as the Lord had told them, and the Lord accepted Job. Now look at, here was his three friends, Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar. They were the ones who kept saying to Job, you're suffering because you're a sinner. You know, you've got hidden sin in your life, that's why you're suffering so much. And God is rebuking them now. And now they've got to make a hefty sacrifice, because look what God requires of them in verse 8. He says, now therefore take for yourselves 7 bulls and 7 rams. All right? Now, I don't know if they had to take 7 each, but I think it's with the 7 for the 3 of them. Okay, 7 bulls. That's quite a hefty sacrifice, and 7 rams to bring it to God, to offer to God as a basically, you know, an atonement, a sin offering before him. And it says that when Job prays for you, that my wrath won't be kindled against you. So it's through the intercession of Job, and when Job intercedes for them and prays for them, then they end up being healed. Because he says here in that verse 9, he says, So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamathite went and did as the Lord told them, and the Lord accepted Job, and the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he prayed for his friends, and the Lord increased all that Job had had twofold. See what I'm saying? In other words, when Job showed mercy to his friends and he prayed for them, interceded for them, then God turned around and blessed him. If you go back and read what I think it was Zophar said, and one of them had said to Job, he says, hey, Job, you're not even being punished half as much as you deserve. Okay, that's what he said to him. But now it's almost as though he sees a situation where, hey, man, if it's not for Job's intercession, you're the one that's going to be really punished and get what you deserve. Because these are the ones that are really sinning. But it's interesting. He just said Eliphaz and his two friends, Zophar and Bildad. He didn't include Elihu. Now, Elihu had a lot to say, but remember, Elihu never came out and accused Job of suffering because of some sin in his life. Rather, Elihu said, look, Job, you say you haven't sinned? Well, I accept you at your word. I believe you. But he said, but you know what? You're sinning now because you're suffering. His other friends were saying, you're suffering because you're sinning, or because you got sin. But Elihu hit it on the head, which says, listen, you're sinning by accusing God of being unjust. So God does not include Elihu in this, as far as being offering up the sacrifice. Anyway, concluding this, from beginning with verse 11, it says, then all of his brothers and his sisters and all who had known him before came to him, and they ate bread with him in his house, and they consoled him and comforted him for all the evil the Lord had brought on him, and each one gave him a piece of money and each a ring of gold. Now it says all of his brothers and his sisters, and I guess a lot of these other people, they all forsook him. You know, he was like somebody with the plague. They just figured, this guy is bad news, this guy's bad luck, this guy, he's cursed of God. And so they all forsook him, but now I think they all began to, when the word got around and God appeared to him in a whirlwind and what God had to say, I think they all felt a little ashamed of themselves, and they went and they made restitution to Job. And it says here in that verse 12, it says, and the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning, and he had 14,000 sheep and 6,000 camel and 1,000 yoke of oxen and 1,000 female donkeys, and he had 7 sons and 3 daughters. Now here's an interesting thing. You go back to that, I think it was the first chapter, Job had 7,000 sheep, but now he's blessed with 14,000 sheep. He had 3,000 camels. Now he has 6,000 camels. He had 500 yoke of oxen. Now he has 1,000 yoke of oxen. But it's interesting that at the beginning, Job had 10 children. Well, it says here in verse 13, and he had 7 sons and 3 daughters. So he had 10 more children. But when he's saying everything Job had was doubled, well, he didn't end up having 20 children after all of this calamity. He only had 10. But it gave him 20. Why?
So you're in heaven.
Because the other 10, you know, even though they had died, all right, they were still alive. They were in a place called paradise, and they were going to see Job someday, all right, again. So it was like he ended up having 20 kids. Even though he lost them, lost 10, he really, in the end, had 20. Right, and then he says here in that verse 13, and he had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he named the first Jemima, and the second was Keziah, and the third was Kirharpuk, and these are the daughters that he names. Now, how would you like a name like that? I don't know. Forget it. But yeah, okay. But interesting thing, they almost always talk about the sons. Well, here he talks about the daughters. And I think it's kind of significant. I know it's speculative on my part, but I think that probably, you know, these daughters were a real comfort to him, and they were the joy of his life. And Jemiah means dove. That's what he named his first daughter. And then Keziah means perfume scent or cinnamon scent. And then the Kiwi harp buck means eye makeup or eye paint or something. He must have beautiful eyes. But anyway, these were his daughters, and they were exceptional. They were an exceptional blessing to him. I think he got a tremendous joy out of those daughters, because what does it say here in that verse 15? And in all the land, no women were found as fair as Job's daughters, and their father gave them inheritance among their brothers. And after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his sons and his grandsons four generations, and Job died an old man full of days. Now, when I read this, it says he lived 140 years. Did he live 140 years after all this calamity? Because if he did, then that would suggest to me that he probably died around 200. All right? Because all this calamity probably struck him when he was around 60. Now, this is speculative on my part. So, you know, when I'm reading this, I'm not quite sure if it's saying that he lived to be 140 years old or he lived 140 years after this disaster. But either way, you know, he had a long, blessed life. Anybody have anything to add or share?
The notes on my Bible says, for like the something the guy already said, and that Job lived to such a great age, he obviously fully recovered his health.
Yeah.
So, I'm guessing, like, it's like he started fresh, like you said, like, you know, he lived an extra 140 years.
Well, yeah, it could be, yeah.
Yeah, my Bible actually says after this, Job lived 140 years.
140 years, yeah. Yeah, well, see, well, it says this in my Bible. After this, Job lived 140 years. So, you see, when you read this, in other words, did he die at 140 years old, or did he die more close to the age of 200? That's neither here nor there, because either way, it's just suggesting strongly to us that he lived a long, good, healthy life after that. Anybody have anything you want to add or share? I mean, this has been a very unique book in many, many ways. I mean, there was a lot of dialogue that went back and forth between Job's three friends and Job himself, and that was kind of monotonous and kind of, I don't know, repetitious. But what this story really, you know, boiled down to its bare essence is the fact that, hey, you know what? We all suffer in life, and we all go through some very, very difficult things. I've read the statistic, and I think I've shared it here before, that they said that the average person can't go 2 weeks without having something happen into his life. Either he comes down with a cold, he's got a car repair, you know, some tragedy, he has something happens to him. I mean, you can hardly go 2 weeks. I mean, I think sometimes I can't go 2 days without something getting hit upside the head with something. But this is part of this fallen world we live in, right? And there's so much suffering, and there's so much pain, and there's so much dying, and there's so many things that we don't have answers for. But for the Christian, In Romans 8, it says, all things work together for good for those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. Look at Job's situation and apply that scripture. All things work together for good for those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. Job, you see, what's interesting about this? God did not explain anything to Job. Job just figured, I'm going to ask God all these questions and God better answer me. Instead, when God appeared to him, God fired over almost 90 questions at him. He couldn't answer one of them. God did not explain himself. He didn't say, Job, this was a challenge I threw out with the devil because I had such confidence in you, you know, that I knew you would pass this test. No, God didn't tell him anything like that. But look at how many multitudes of people throughout the centuries have been blessed by this book because of what Job had went through. And they have found inspiration. They have found the courage to hang on. They have found the ability to just hang in there when they feel like they're at their wits' end or at the point of despair in their life. They look at Job and his patience, and they look at how God worked that out in his life. And people have found tremendous encouragement in this book. That's why I think that God had allowed this thing to happen. You know, one of the reasons was because look at how many people have been blessed because of it. Anybody want to add or share before we close tonight?